email ray@rte.ie. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Niall Quinn, good afternoon.
Hi Ray, how are you?
It's a busy night of football tonight, isn't it?
Yeah, big night over at the Aviva, and then there's lots of European action as well, so plenty there.
So how many of your former clubs are in action tonight?
Man City and Arsenal, I would think.
Champions League, yeah.
Yeah, and that's it, Sunderland. Oh, they've Leeds, of course.
Yes,
yes they do. So big one against Leeds, yeah.
So what do you do in a night like tonight?
Oh, gosh, well, I'm kind of betwixt and between who I want to win the Premier League, you know, because I think it would be good for the game if Arsenal did that. But City have been so impressive. So I feel bad when, you know, when you play with somebody and you don't say you want them to win the league, because I got a lot of abuse then from fans.
Yeah.
But Sunderland, I'd just love to see them to win a game, to be honest. They've gone on a very bad run. They've had a chaotic time of it since Tony Mowbray left the club a few months ago. They were in great shape in the playoffs, and now the dream is over for another year getting into the Premier League. And I think it's, I suppose, head-scratching time for them there. But and it all goes to show that I'm kind of glad I'm out of it, right? and not going through all that stuff.
But I read a quote from your book there about those three clubs. And I can't remember, but you might remember it.
Oh, I will. So, I learned my trade at Arsenal,
yeah.
Became a footballer at Man City, but I fell in love with Sunderland.
Uh-huh.
And I think that stands to this day.
Does it?
What I would give to see Sunderland playing in the Champions League, but of course that's a bit far-fetched at the moment. And it was always the aim that we would get the club to Europe when I played, and we finished fifth 2 years in a row, but that wasn't good enough to, or seventh, I should say. Sorry, I was fifth at Man City when there was less places in Europe. But we finished seventh 2 years in a row, just outside top six. So we never got there. And then in an administrative role as chairman, we didn't get there either. We finished 10th was the best. But
Was it about Sunderland?
Well, it means so much to the people up there. You know, I think anybody who saw the Netflix documentary Sunderland Till I Die came away and said, wow, it's religion, it's everything. And I think when you're up there and you're part of that and you buy into it and you kind of ride that wave and you see what it all means to everybody up there, you can't help but be captivated.
Yeah,
by it,
of course,
you know?
Man City, Manchester has Manchester United, Arsenal is in London, has numerous other clubs.
Yeah.
But in Sunderland, it's all about Sunderland.
Well, if you think about this, right, Sunderland had a couple of 100,000 people in the city and surrounds. We had 50 of them coming to the games every week. So that's, if you can imagine a quarter of London going to see Arsenal, then you'll get the kind of... Yeah. The idea of what it means.
Because the game was the game.
That's it.
Like if you were in London, you say you're over for the game. They go,
which one?
It could be a rugby match. It could be any one of the numbers.
That's it. Yeah, Sunderland was great to me. I really sincerely enjoyed my time there. And I don't know, maybe my career was coming to an end too and I valued it more. You know, maybe when you're younger, you don't realise what's happening. But the last few years I had at Sunderland there will always be the ones that I prefer.
We might come back to it. We might come back to that. But you're in town today for the launch of the Dylan Quirk Foundation. And I was listening to Dan, Dylan's dad, on Morning Ireland this morning. And Dylan died August 2022 at the age of 24, playing a senior club hurling game in Tipperary.
Yeah, and Dylan, you know, was a brilliant guy. I knew Dylan for quite some time. Dan and Hazel have been great friends of ours for many, many years. And as Dylan started to progress from minors to under-21s into the senior panel, you know, it was a joy to see how proud his parents were and his sisters of him. And it was also great to see him develop as a young man, because he became the life and soul of the dressing room, both at club level and county level. He had a head on his shoulders. He was way ahead of his time in many respects, a leader. And it was all, you know, going so well for him. And then that tragic event happened in Semple Stadium and the world changed. And I think the only way I look back at it now is to come out of that apocalypse, to come out of the darkness the way the family have done, to make sure that no other families suffer the way they did. It's more than commendable. It's incredible. And to be asked then to chair their foundation and to you know, come in and to see the outpouring of support from the country. You know, imagine we were at a launch today, Ray, and we had to tell the people at the launch that we already have 1.3 million in.
Wow.
as a charity. I mean, that's quite incredible. But that will tell you that comes from every walk of life. There's philanthropy, there's corporates that are in supporting it. There are individuals, you know, doing events, there are clubs. And the greatest thing about it all, because I was very conscious that I was asked by a strong GAA family to come in and help, you know, an incredible foundation, but I was hoping, I didn't want to overpush it, that all sports would be considered at that time. And here we are sort of 6, 8, 9 months down the line since we first started chatting about it. All sports are very much involved.
So Dylan suffered from sudden adult death syndrome.
Yeah.
And there's been a number of high profile deaths, GA and other sports, over the years. So 24. So the foundation then, their goal, what's their mission statement?
So there's two goals. And just to go back a little bit, yes, there have been a high profile deaths, but there's been a lot under the radar too. And so we, as in this country, lose about 100 people to this silent killer, if you like. SADS a year.
Right.
And that's a high number.
And what's the age ceiling on it?
Well, it'd be nice to you know, in our world, we think the nicest place to do this is when a 12-year-old is starting to play sport, a little bit more energetically than perhaps in younger years. I think that's a good time to start this process, right the way up then to your 18, 19, and then if there's anything there, you'll know about
it. So it's screening.
It's cardiac screening. That's exactly what it is. And I think the aim of the foundation, and again, pointing back to Dylan's family and their desire to see no other family suffer like they have, is to get as many young people screened as possible. And that's why all the sports coming together makes it a louder voice, a louder ask. And I guess that's the short-term aim, is to get as many in as possible. The long to medium to long aim, I think, you know, undoubtedly is that government will go all the way and make it mandatory for young people entering into the world of sport to have cardiac screening. Now, does that sound far-fetched? No, for two reasons. One, in Italy, they brought this in. It's a law in Italy. If you're playing sport that requires intensive training or competition, you have to have screening. Their SADS decreased by 89%.
Right.
So it's a huge marker for every one of us to think about. And then when you come to the cost that people might say, hey, you know, it's very costly. How can sport do that? The government for 2024 kindly gave sport, or are giving sport, $183.3 million this year. Can you imagine, Ray, if there was a prerequisite to every sport drawing down that money, that to qualify, they had to screen their kids?
Yeah.
And I think, given that there's an election year coming up and that pot might even increase, wouldn't it be great if government said, yeah, we're very happy to give this money?
Screening is expensive though, isn't it?
Well, it can get expensive if you're referred and, you know, there's further actions to be taken, but screening with the Dylan Quirk Foundation is free. So
how does it work?
So, funny enough, I've just come from Nafina today, the GA club out in the Dublin North Side of Movie Road, and I saw it in action for the first time. There's about 1,200 kids being screened already by the foundation, and that'll go to 10,000 by the end of the year, which is enormous. But to see it in action and to see the parents come in with their children, young players playing for Nafina, boys and girls, to see them, they go into the reception area, they've already booked their time slot, they're brought in, the whole situation is explained to them. They first of all go in and they do the ECGs where they're strapped up and they're you know.
Is this a mobile
yeah,
screening
yeah,
unit?
Yeah, it's a group down in Cork, Advanced Medical Solutions. They're very good. They've done 300,000 screenings. So we're very confident that we've got the best people in the business. And the experience is, it can be daunting before you get there on the basis that everybody worries, what if, you know? But isn't it like, you know, I suppose it is, you know, fair to say that really all of us want to know and all of us need to know if our children have something. And the majority of abnormalities are correctable very quickly and you just are put onto a better path. Very seldom, but of course it does happen that the abnormality is that strong that something extra has to happen. And I think on that score today, we've a number of people who came and spoke to us today, but Saoirse came from Mayo and she was just unbelievable. 8 weeks ago in training, she got tested. And Saoirse Lally, captain of Mayo. And Saoirse was in shock at first. She'll tell her own story to you. Please don't let me ruin it on her. She's just an amazing orator, a fabulous person. And she was in a bit of denial for a few days because she was called back in. Oh, what's this? We've got a big game coming up. Then it was told there was a kind of a problem here. You know, we might need you to go a little bit further. So she rang her her union, the Gaelic Players Association, and they arranged for her to go up to the Beacon. And she was operated on within 24 hours.
Wow.
The good news is, you know, that whole story has gone into a great place, because now, six, seven weeks after that operation, she's starting the road back to training and becoming a county player and hopes to play again this year. Yeah. So that's what it can do in the...
Yeah, because it could have panned out a lot differently, a lot more tragically.
Well, that's it. And it's, you know, it's a tough one to think about. But had Dylan got that...
Yes.
I think we might be in a different position altogether. But there again...
And of course, the other thing about this is, you know, it's not just for sport. It's saving money down the line as well, because these people grow into adults, yeah, and if they spot any sort of cardiac problems early on, they can be treated.
Well, that's it. But I think governments are more caught in their lifetime circles of their 4 years and wanting to do what they have to do. And again, I point back, it's great. The money that goes into sport is great. So I think, you know, government need to be commended for that. But wouldn't it be lovely just to see it ring-fenced by, you know, screen your young people. Let's bring the 100 deaths down to 11.
Yeah. And what a great legacy for Dylan.
Yeah.
And it's brilliant to see that his parents are channeling their grief into something.
Yeah, no, they're so an extraordinary brilliant family, and they give you inspiration, you know, and the support that backs that up then from first of all, the GAA world, but now that it's spread out, and to see soccer, rugby and horse racing there today, and to see that the Athletes Alliance that was announced yesterday. So all those sports coming together, all of the elite players and representatives coming together to have a louder voice and beginning their process of bettering their stakeholders by all joining in and supporting the Dylan Quirk Foundation so everybody gets tested.
And you have a connection with Tipperary.
Oh, well, all belong to me are from Tipperary.
Oh, right. Yeah, so, I know you're, we claim you in Kildare. You know,
I'm invited to Kildare when I finish football, but my Tipperary connections are, my mum and dad were at Tipperary, they ended up in Dublin, I had three sisters, I was the first to leave home, and the three of them ended up going down to Tipperary, getting married, and they all say on the phone now, well, how's it going? You know, and I grew up with them in Crumlin in Dublin, but in Parrystown. Yeah. But that's it. They're very much Tipperary-fied, and I get caught in the crossfire sometimes. My friends in Dublin give out to me because they think I'm not a real dub, and in Tipperary they think I'm a bit of a dub. So I get caught.
And Kildare is in the middle there.
Kildare's in the middle, yeah. Kildare's been good to me. It's fine.
Yeah. You know what struck me reading about you, and I've spoken to you before, but you're sort of a leader. In a way, the people go to you to be, for example, front this organisation. You know, you were the chairperson at Sunderland. You've had other managerial roles over the years. And I met you were chairperson of the Kildare Sports Partnership. I took over from you.
Yeah.
Difficult shoes to fill and never managed to do it, mind you.
Right.
Is that something that you enjoy doing, or do you get asked so many times that you just go, I better say yes to someone?
No, I think... you know, there has to be an appeal of sorts, and sport is obviously a very appealing place for me. It was everything to me, still is. Though there would be occasions when I'd be asked to play golf somewhere lovely and there'd be a meeting on, you going, what did I go to that meeting for? I'm missing out on golf. But yeah. I think in general, it's about giving back. Sport was very good to me. My first sort of experience in all this, I was asked to go on what was then called the Irish Sports Council. And I was there.
That's Sports Ireland now, is it?
Sport Ireland now. And I was there, and I went to my first meeting, you know, I was petrified, and I was there to, you know, give football in this country a voice. And they put me sitting beside the famous Brian Mullins, Lord of Mercyham, and Mick O'Dwyer from the GA world. And I couldn't get a word in for 6 months, you know. But it was a great learning curve, and to see how boardrooms work, and to see how sport is thought of, because there was a lot of politicians around that board and there was a lot of sporting icons. And and it was great grounding. John Tracy and Minister John O'Donoghue at the time had invited me in. And I stayed till I had to go back over to Sunderland. I went over to Sunderland for 6 years. So I did four years with the Sports Council, but learned a lot.
So you've been in a lot of boardrooms over the years.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the politics of that, and how effective some are more than others, without naming anything.
Yeah, I think
what makes an effective board?
Well, I only know the world of football, and in football, you generally get on well if you have a good dressing room. So as a player, all the best times I had were in great dressing rooms where people had your back and where you minded each other. The ones that I struggled in was when individuals came in, weren't pulling the same weight as others, and, you know, disenchantment sets in, and you have, on top of that, you have a media looking in and making it all that more exhausting to try and pull yourself out of. And fighting that fight in a bad dressing room is just... It's just so hard to do. And truthfully, I've witnessed good and bad. And
so you're equating a dressing room to a boardroom, or a boardroom
The only thing I know is a dressing room.
Right.
And when those and so my business record mightn't be the best, but I try. I get up and try and score goals in business, and everything I do, I know the dressing room. The dressing room is just so important.
And that's about the team, and it's about the atmosphere.
It's about
the team.
And the best player in the team isn't the show off who scores the goals. The best player in the team is who rounds everybody up, gets everybody doing the right thing, gets in before everybody else, sets examples. It's the same in a boardroom, you know, and there are boardrooms that have cracks in it, no doubt about it. And that to me is the same as a dressing room with one or two people who aren't aligned with the philosophy of others. And that's, you know, to me, a boardroom, a dressing room, I keep referring back to it. It's about having everyone plugging the same way. And that's not always easy.
So you've been around now for the trials and tribulations of Irish football. When you started playing football, we were winning left, right, and centre. It was back in 1990. We qualified for you scored an equaliser against Netherlands, didn't you, to get us
in the World Cup? Back in the day.
Yeah, and we thought it was going to go on forever.
But you must remember at the time, you know, for any of us to go over to England and make it with the top clubs like Arsenal, where I was, Man United, Liverpool, like, you know, the Ronnie Whelans and the Paul McGraths of this world, we only had to be better than the British Isles, than anybody from Scotland, Wales or England. And now we're looking at our players who are, and we have some doing great stuff in the Premier League, and maybe not at the top level of clubs. But the big issue is you now got to be better than South Americans. You got to be better than Europeans. It's
Salah,
a tough, it's, yeah, yes, yeah. It's a tough, tough gig. And that's why.
And if the players aren't getting top flight football, then.
Very difficult for them to turn up and play for Ireland, suddenly turn into those top players that you know they're supposed to be because of legacy and because of the Irish team doing what we did all those years ago. So it's not, isn't it funny? I look at it now, we had nothing but good times, particularly under Jack, Mick for the latter years. And it was such a privilege and a joy to play with Ireland. You'd be hiding injuries to get over because the buzz was so big. Everybody supported you. You know, the people were behind you. I guess it must be a lot more difficult for the players these days. You know, I know I look at them and they sing their national anthem with pride, and of course they'll always be thrilled to play with Ireland, but they mightn't just have it as good as we had. And I think that's a step I'd love to see changing.
And then of course off the pitch there are stories as well, and they're obviously getting those on social media, or reading the papers or wherever. The FAI is in a bit of disarray.
Well, yes, I do.
You were in there for...
I was there for the pandemic. Yeah. I was there for 9 or 10 months.
Deputy CEO or...
I was deputy CEO, there were roles that I was heavily involved in and others I wasn't. In terms of the governance that we were sent in to help with, thankfully...
And this was post John Delaney.
Yeah, just after John had left. And at that time, getting the game to accept it needed to change wasn't simple. But of course, the government held the key hand in that debate. And
when
that
you
they,
say getting the game
governance.
To change,
the governance, as opposed to the 4-3 versus yes, exactly. So to get the governance to change within... the framework of how football is rolled out in this country. It was a difficult task because we were coming out of a tough situation and trying to find ways that would give government confidence to start funding the game again. 200 jobs at risk in those days, but eventually the game voted overwhelmingly to accept new governance proposals. And I think in the last couple of years, that side, things have started to settle down. Now, someone will immediately point to, hey, but the current CEO's salary, €12,000, isn't that terrible? Did anybody ever think of saying, that's the new governance? It was cut after €12,000, not €67 million.
That's one way of looking at it.
It's the only way of looking at it when you've been in there trying to make change. Yeah. And... obviously,
so you're talking about Jonathan Hill. And
he
got paid for holidays he didn't take.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And he was up in front of
within a month or two.
Okay,
and I think that in itself shows you that, you know, the association are doing the right thing. The leaks have stopped. You know, there was leaks all through that process of trying to get into good places. You know, people putting stuff in the media that they wanted from their side. You know, that seems to have really stopped. In fact, it's good that. none of us really know who the next manager is going to be because that...
Well, is that good? That's because that's we have to come
it's
on to
great.
That.
Because I think it's great.
When did Stephen Kenny leave? November, was it?
A long time ago, yeah.
Yes, yeah,
yeah.
Long time ago.
Yeah.
And there's been, you know, all sorts of rumours swirling around, all sorts of names mentioned. Then John O'Shea came in for two games as interim manager. He expressed his desire to be the full-time man.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We spoke to him about it. He didn't know, and I believed him when he said he didn't know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And now, just today, I'm just looking at the time here, today at 13:44, Anthony Barry is back on the FAI's radar. So tell us about Anthony Barry. He's with Bayern Munich.
Are you certain he's on the FAI's radar? The betting suggests in the last hour or two that he is. But I think this has been quite unusual that there has been no leaks and that they've been steadfast in not getting that sort of decision out there. You just spoke about good boardrooms a few minutes ago.
Yes.
You know, a good boardroom doesn't leak.
Right.
And that's my point. You know, so whoever gets this job, I'll be very supportive anyway. Look, so Anthony is the latest one. I think it was Roy Keane a week or two ago. Gus Poyet,
yes.
You know. I don't think the association has to answer to all that noise that's going
on. What would you do? Because is there, like, Stephen Kenny's gone since November. We're now in April. And people want some sort of certainty. I'm sure the team want certainty.
Yeah,
They're looking to the FAI and they're going, come on, lads.
I don't know. I'm not in there anymore. It's been a couple of years since I was anywhere near the place. But yeah. I do think they have obviously got someone in mind that they wanted in and that has contracted elsewhere. Anthony Barry fits that profile alone. What do I know?
So
I don't know.
So he was in the Irish setup before.
Yeah, I don't know. He was around, you know, when Stephen had possibly some of his better performances. And the only thing I do know, the word that came out to me was that the players loved working with them. I don't know him other than that, so I'm not here to say he's the man or anything like that. I'm kind of here to say I respect the process that's going on.
Yeah.
Others mightn't. I hope when everything settles that there's room for Brian Kerr in there as a father figure to a very young squad. But then, you know, whoever comes in might want to bring all their own people, as Stephen did, you know, back in the day. And so that's not a simple process either. But just a bit of patience is needed, I think. Let's see where this goes in the next couple of weeks.
And just for my information, other people know this, but when you come in and you bring your own people in, they're all on similar contracts to the boss man. So if you get a two-year contract, your backroom team get a two-year contract as well.
Yeah, and you get rid of the people who were there before you.
Right.
So that's just another bone of contention. That's the game.
It's a bit like politics, isn't it?
In lots of ways,
Simon
yeah.
Harris is bringing all his people in. Well, not all, but I mean his advisors and all that.
Yeah, you could look at it in much the same way. Yeah. But there are people who do great jobs in behind the scenes and they get whisked away regardless of how good they've done. And I think that's always the difficult thing with managers coming in and demanding to have their own people in there. But that's the way the game works.
We had your son in talking about research into the reaction time of goalkeepers.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated by that sort of stuff. So we had a great chat.
He did. Thanks very much. Yeah, he really loved coming in here. He got a lot of publicity about it.
Michael.
Mikey, yeah. So he's over in Boston. He's landed a nice job over in Boston. He's done well with his visa applications and he's living the life in that field. He's not missing home at all. No, by the sound of things.
So the field is
well, he works for a biotech company and they look at assisting and helping, I suppose, all of that kind of world along. Now, I'm not here to stand up for that industry. I've no idea.
Elite athletes, is it?
Well, there's a number of areas. You know, in terms of biotech, it's to understand and help out companies more who are in that world. That's the company he's working with. But I think, you know, it suits him down to the ground, you know. Like, we didn't put too much pressure on Mikey. I was a big shadow on him as a kid.
He was a goalkeeper.
He was a half decent goalkeeper.
Yes, yeah.
You know, had he got the desire and urge to go all the way, not from 4 years of age to 18, he maybe got that at 14, 15. He then went between Gaelic football and soccer. But he enjoyed it and he loves it and he still does. And he's joined the GAA club out in Boston and he's looking at coaching goalkeepers in the soccer. And he'll always be close to the game that way. And that's why, you know, he was destined for something else in the game and, you know, getting such publicity as he did to work out that goalkeepers are different. And I think the way it was taken up by most places that goalkeepers are a bit madder than the rest of the than the rest of the soccer players or the Gaelic players. And he got a lot of publicity out of that, but it's right up his street. You know, he loves that world. And we're delighted.
I think if my memory serves me correctly, he found out they were different.
He proved they were different, I think. Have I got news for you? Come on, and said that, yeah, that's it. They're definitely mad. They're mad in the head. So I got ex-goalkeepers, friends of mine, getting onto Twitter, giving out to me, you know, what's your son doing? We're not all mad, but no, it was good. He's done well, thanks.
And the fact that you are a dad probably makes this connection stronger when you listen to Dan Quirk talking about Dylan Quirk. Mm-hmm. So the Dylan Quirk Foundation, if people want to know, and clubs of all types can sign up and express interest in this screening process.
Yeah. Come on to the Dylan Quirk Foundation website and we'll take it from there. Okay. You know, there's 10,000 more to be done this year. And one of the things, just in finishing out on that, Ray, we'll keep going till government does mandate this. And so we'll always be there. As I said, you know, the money's there, but the money will be spent. You know, and we've got a system now where we're going to get through, as say, it'll be nearly 11,500, 12,000 this time next year. When we look at this, I'll come back into you, see where we are, see where government are. But at the same time, you know, it really should be part of a government manifesto.
You're creating a template.
That's it. And we'll see it through until the right thing is done.
So you're off to the game tonight.
I will go and see the women tonight.
Well,
yeah.
What do you think?
They were unlucky the other night in some ways. A little bit lackadaisical start against the French. They're doing great things. It's going to be great just to be there and see the support, you know, that they're going to get. We've some world-class players. Denise O'Sullivan, I went and got to meet Denise and spoke to her and interviewed her out in Carolina, where she's based. Full of admiration for her. Katie McCabe, like, we've got some serious people there. You know, really aiming high and wanting to get there. I just hope it works out for them. It's the toughest group. Oh my God, what a group to get into. But they'll come out fighting, and my hope is that they'll keep writing this chapter that they're writing for Irish women's football.
Niall, great to see you.
You too.
So much.
Thanks for having me.
Your time.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.